Welcome to part two of Noam Chomsky's Gaza update from Mandela's Cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is the question and answer segment of the evening.
My name is Dahlia, and I have a question for Professor Chomsky. In this kind of worse than apartheid system, to borrow your words, can you talk a little bit about the hierarchy of rights that are established with Jewish Israelis at the top and Palestinian refugees at the bottom, and perhaps the impact that has on the fragmentation of the Palestinian experience and resistance?
Well, yes. Yeah, it's an important question. But we have to recognize that it's segmented. It's not uniform throughout the areas of Palestinian life. So in the West Bank, it's much worse than apartheid, for the reasons I mentioned. The Palestinians really are unpeople. Anything can be done to them, and it happens all the time. I don't have to go through, in fact, take this land expropriation, the 1,000 acres that Israel just took. They had a pretext. There's always a pretext for anything. The pretext was that this was revenge for the Palestinian, for what they call Hamas's killing of the three Israeli teenagers, settler teenagers. As they know, it wasn't a Hamas operation. But what's interesting is that that was considered legitimate. As I'm sure you know, right at the same time, a Palestinian boy was burned to death. But there's no land expropriation of Israelis for that. For the last 14 years, Israel's been killing more than two Palestinian children a week for 14 years. No land expropriations for that. No land expropriations for the massacres in Gaza. Now, that's the difference between people and unpeople. And it's accepted. Like, if you read discussion here, nobody talks about it. It's kind of taken for granted. That's deep-seated imperial ideology. The unpeople, you do anything you want to. That's the West Bank, much worse than apartheid. Within Israel itself, there's plenty of discrimination and repression, but I don't think the term apartheid is appropriate. It's not like South African apartheid. It's more like what we're pretty familiar with right here. If you take a look at our own country, the first slaves were brought 500 years ago. That's 500 years since the first slaves were brought right in Massachusetts. During this 500 years, there have been maybe, I won't run through the whole history, but if you think it through, there have been maybe three or four decades in the last 500 years in which African Americans had a kind of a shot at a more or less at a life pretty much like that of the white majority. It's pretty awful. Maybe it's worse than apartheid, but it's not apartheid. It's something different. In Israel, there is repression, but I don't think apartheid's the right word. In Israel, in fact, a civil rights struggle for Palestinian rights can succeed, and in fact, to some extent, is succeeding. The most extreme violation of the rights of Palestinian citizens within Israel was the land laws. The land laws, through a variety of legal and administrative and other conditions, which I won't run through, they effectively place about 90% of the land in the hands of an organization which is committed by its charter with the government of Israel to work for the benefit, I'm quoting, the benefit of people of the Jewish race, religion, and origin. That's 90% of the land, a kind of arcane system of laws and regulations which leads to that. That's pretty extreme. I mean, if 90% of the land in the United States was restricted to people of a Christian, white Christian race, religion, and origin, we'd consider it pretty serious. Well, that has been chipped away at. There is an Israeli civil rights organization, kind of like the ACLU, which finally got the Supreme Court to, in a limited way, say that that's unconstitutional, that's in violation of their basic law. That's year 2000, since 15 years ago. It still hasn't been much implemented, but they're chipping away at it. That's the kind of thing that can be done within a system of significant repression, but not apartheid. And it's happening. It's not acceptable, but not apartheid. You go to, say, the refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan, there it's really a monstrous situation. So in Lebanon, Lebanon, unlike the United States, does accept refugees. Here we throw refugees back to the countries of origin, horrible conditions and so on. But Lebanon probably has more, surely has more refugees relative to the population than any other country. A lot of Palestinians, recently Syrians. The way they're treated is pretty shocking. I don't know if any of you have been in Lebanese refugee camps, but it's one of the most depressing sights you can see. They're not starving. You know, they're sort of, I've seen worse slums, but you see a little kid playing in the dirt in a dark alley, and you know that he's going to be there all his life, and his children are going to be there all his life, and it's going to go on forever, and there's no way out. They're not admitted into Lebanese society. It's pretty grim. That's the refugee camps. And then there's the Palestinian diaspora elsewhere where the situation is different. So it's a fragmented story. No, not pretty anywhere. But the core part is what the Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling, who I mentioned before, called politicide, destroying the possibility of gaining rights as an entity, as a recognized entity. That's dedicated U.S.-backed Israeli policy and has been for far back as you go.
Okay. Thank you so much for your insights. My name is Tariq Amrani. My question is about the many factors you have listed, external factors about Israeli people. They will like relax its condition on the people in Gaza. How about the internal factors, the resilience itself? We see in the last war that in Gaza, everybody come together, and the way how they fight and co-fight Israeli power, it's different this time. Can we consider this as another factor and very important player in this conflict, given that the people in Gaza at this last war, they reached Ben Gurion with their rockets, they built very strong tunnels underneath the ground. So can you, sir, clarify more about this factor, the internal factor in Gaza? Thank you so much.
So you're speaking of the effectiveness of the resistance within Gaza, which was greater than, say, Casled,
yes,
considerably. But that's a pretty small victory. Gaza was destroyed. It's just devastated. Now, from Israel's point of view, this is maybe a slight bloody nose. But for Gaza, it's devastating. With that kind of victory, you're better off with defeats. You know, it is true that it raised the spirits of Palestinians. There was a recent poll by Shikaki, the main polling agency in the West Bank, who found pretty remarkable results. I don't remember the exact figures, but support for Hamas in the West Bank just escalated. It turned out by his figures that if there was an election now, Ismail Haniyeh would easily win the election. There is a kind of a sense that Palestinians did stand up and fight back. They didn't just die quietly, as happened in Casled. But that's not a winning strategy. You can just take more and more destruction. Raji Sarani, you may know, a wonderful person. He's a very distinguished internationally recognized human rights lawyer, lives in Gaza for many years. He's pointed out for years that Gazans have basically two choices now. They can die quietly, or they can die with dignity. And, of course, that's not the choice that you'd prefer.
Hey, I'm Mohammed, and I just wanted to ask, what's the most appropriate and effective way for us to spread our views in a country where both the ruling parties have a pretty much one-sided understanding of the conflict?
Same as all other issues. I mean, on most issues, the two parties have one position. Let's take, say, the Vietnam War, the worst crime in the post-war era, post-Second World War era. Huge, monstrous crime. Both parties supported it all the way through. In fact, I mentioned to somebody at dinner tonight that my own experience as an anti-war activist here, the representatives I was able to get most support from, the ones who I could say invite over to the congressional representatives, invite over to the House to meet groups of people who would kind of argue with them about the war, they were Republicans because they were less supportive of the war than the Democrats were. It was a Democratic war. But basically both parties were totally in support of it. A couple of scattered people, you know, practically nothing. But a powerful anti-war movement did develop, and it was significant. It played didn't end the atrocities, but it limited them significantly. You can find out how significant it was by reading the Pentagon Papers, you know, famous Pentagon Papers. And one of their most interesting parts, which is never discussed, is the last section. The Pentagon Papers end, the record ends in mid-1968. In January 1968, there was a huge uprising in Vietnam, South Vietnam, the Tet Offensive, it's called. Extraordinary popular uprising. It caught the American forces totally by surprise. And it was just enormous. It's hard to find a historical parallel. The president, President Johnson, wanted to send a couple hundred thousand more troops. But the record, internal record, indicates that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were opposed to that because they said they would need the troops here for civil disorder control because of the uprising among young people, among minorities, among women and others. They thought the country was going to blow up. That affects policy. And in fact, it did affect policy. And it can be done in other issues where there's bipartisan support for criminal atrocities. In fact, in this case, much worse ones than is support for Israeli crimes is bad enough, but the Vietnam War is incomparably worse, a horrifying crime. But nevertheless, it was possible to affect it. And there are other cases. So to take another one, which I was involved in for many years. In 1975, Indonesia invaded the territory of East Timor, former Portuguese territory. It was as close to genocide as anything in the modern period. They may have killed maybe a quarter of the population. U.S. supported it completely from the first minute, gave it overwhelming support. This went on until 1999. The Indonesian generals were completely confident. They said, we're going to hold on to this forever. We don't care what anybody thinks. In September 1999, President Clinton, who was under quite considerable domestic pressure and international pressure, simply informed the Indonesian generals that the game is over. And the next day they withdrew. That's what power is. Now, there are other cases. South Africa's somewhat similar. It can happen. And there are concrete things that can be done. I think very concrete things. So one of the crucial elements of U.S. support is military support. And a call for an arms embargo against Israel, I think, could have plenty of popular support for all sorts of reasons. For one thing, it's literally against U.S. law. U.S. law bans export or sale of arms to any military entity that is using them for violation of human rights. Well, I mean, that applies to Israel overwhelmingly. So in fact, all the dispatch of arms is in violation of U.S. law as well as international law. And there's plenty of, you know, a lot of Americans don't like the idea of just giving weapons to people to kill somebody else. That could be a very powerful campaign, I think, and could get congressional support. For all kind of, we might not like the reasons, but for a lot of reasons, including budgetary reasons, and it would be a very good organizing point. It's worth bearing in mind that American public opinion has changed a lot over recent years, quite a lot. I can see it in my own personal experience. I mean, I've been giving talks on these topics for 50 years. I literally had police protection, even at MIT, my own university, until about 15 years ago. Other places even more so. Now, that's all gone. Nothing like it. Now, by now, Palestinian solidarity is one of the biggest issues on campus. Big, engaged audiences willing to undertake strong actions, very little. Can hardly get a hostile question. That can be organized into an effective political force, a force which will end this kind of obscene behavior of Congress, where you get unanimous support for utterly outrageous resolutions because the representatives figure that there's no cost. There can be a cost, a public cost. That makes a big difference. So I think the policy is not immune. It can be changed, as it has been in other places. And that's really the one hope. Otherwise, what I've described, I think will just continue.
Thank you.
My name's Marilyn Frankenstein. I wonder if you could comment some, it connects to your last comments about the incredible support that Israel gets, and I know the AIPAC, and in Europe too, are there AIPAC equivalents in Europe? Why? It seems like such a stranglehold, and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and all of them.
Part of the reason why it's overwhelming is that it's an open door. There's no cost at all to supporting Israel, and that's our fault. There ought to be a cost. If you look at the roots of U.S. support, it's complicated. There is a lobby. AIPAC is a significant lobby. But, you know, AIPAC is a very small lobby. I mean, as compared, say, with the military lobby, it's very small. If the U.S. military lobby, say, turned against Israel, AIPAC would disappear. The business lobbies are much greater than any of them. Chamber of Commerce, others. I mean, an ethnic-based lobby can have some influence when it doesn't have much opposition and when it lines up with American policy. In fact, if you look over the years, there have been repeated times when AIPAC's position, which is basically the hawkish Israeli government position, was conflicted with U.S. government policy, and in every such case, of course, AIPAC has to back down. That happens over and over. In fact, it's happening right now. AIPAC tried very hard to get Congress to pass a resolution which would have, in effect, undermined the U.S.-Iran negotiations, and the government didn't want it. Israel backed off. AIPAC disappeared. That's been going on for years. 1982, the United States backed Reagan, backed Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Up till mid-August 1982, by August 1982, the invasion was causing such international outrage that it was harming U.S. interests. Even Thomas Friedman, New York Times correspondent, who was then in Beirut, started writing articles about how it's not fun to be under Israeli bombs. That's pretty extreme for him. And it was becoming a real embarrassment for the U.S. Israel was very dedicated to continuing that. You think back to the time Menachem Begin, who was the prime minister, was talking about how he finally had cornered Hitler in his bunker. He was still fighting the Second World War. Hitler, namely Arafat, was cornered, and now he was going in for the kill. This was a big, serious issue. Reagan simply informed him, like Clinton and the Indonesians that it's over. And they pulled out. No AIPAC, no opposition. The relations of power are very clear. There's case after case like that. So, for example, in 2005, its economy is largely based on high-tech military development and export. And it wants the big market that it would like to break into is China. But the United States doesn't want them to do it. So repeatedly, they've tried to break into the Chinese market, and the United States slammed them down. The last time was 2005, when they insisted that they were going to go ahead no matter what the U.S. said. The Bush administration, this is Bush 2, said you can't do it, and went out of their way to humiliate them. They refused to allow high-level U.S.-Israeli officials to come to Washington. They insisted that Israel write an apology for trying to do this and that they commit themselves to not doing it again. And, of course, they accepted it. What can they do? AIPAC had nothing to say about it. It's significant, but you shouldn't overdo it. It's significant mainly because it usually lines up with U.S. policy, and it has very little in the way of opposition. When it does oppose U.S. policy, it doesn't get anywhere. So that gets back to the real question. What's the source of U.S. support for Israel? Similar things hold in Europe, but it's much more extreme here. There's a lot of factors here, quite a lot, and they're worth thinking through. One of them is just geostrategic. Israel is regarded, and has been since 1948, as a major military ally. Back in 1948, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were very impressed by Israel's military success in the 48 war and concluded that Israel could be a valuable base for U.S. power in the region. They described it as the second major military force in the region after Turkey, which is a NATO ally. And that's remained true. Israel's, I won't go through the whole details, but that's been true throughout. In 1967, when U.S. policy towards Israel really changed, before 67 it was supportive, but nothing like it's been since. Something happened in 67. Israel performed a major service for the United States and its main regional ally, Saudi Arabia. It's worth remembering that the United States, like Britain before it, has tended pretty consistently to support extremist radical Islam in opposition to secular nationalism for pretty good reasons. And there was a conflict going on between them in the mid-60s, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Egypt was secular nationalist. There was a war going on in the Yemen, literally between them. And it was a major conflict over who's going to dominate the region. Israel solved that problem. They smashed secular nationalism. And a big boost to Saudi Arabia and also to the United States. Happened again in 1970, in Black September. And it continued. We just saw it a couple of weeks ago. A few weeks ago, you remember, in the middle of Operation Protective Edge, this latest horror, the United States released arms to Israel. Now, take a look at what they released. They released arms that were pre-positioned in Israel. Those are U.S. arms, which the U.S. places in Israel, which they regard as a U.S. military base, for potential use by U.S. forces. That's a significant contribution. It's a base where you can put your arms and you can get them when you need them. They released some to Israel. U.S. military industry is very supportive of Israel. In fact, one of the most interesting WikiLeaks exposures, which didn't get any publicity, unfortunately, was a list of the about a dozen of the most important strategic sites for the United States, the ones that it must protect above anything else. One of them was right near Haifa, Rafael Military Industries. It's a major military industry. Among other things, it pioneered and produced drones, but a lot of high-tech equipment. And it's basically a U.S. industry. In fact, the relations are so close that Rafael actually moved its management headquarters to Washington, where the money is. When the U.S. taxpayer pays Lockheed Martin to send F-16s to Israel to bomb Gaza, Lockheed Martin makes money, but it makes more than that, because that's what's called in the retail industry a teaser. Saudi Arabia comes along and says, hey, we want that stuff 10 times as much, in fact. So the U.S. military industry can sell second-rate U.S. equipment to Saudi Arabia. I think $60 billion was the latest sale, which can rust in the desert somewhere that makes the princes feel good. That's a terrific boost for military industry. Israel tries out high-tech military technology against defenseless targets. That's very good for developing a military and repressive technology. This is a very close alliance, and it extends over the whole corporate economy. Warren Buffett, for example, recently bought a multi-billion-dollar firm in Israel, and he announced that Israel's the best place for U.S. investment outside the United States. The Intel, big chip manufacturer, the biggest one, is setting up its biggest new generation chip factory in Israel. They get fairly cheap, high-tech, educated labor, and so on. These are very close connections. And in addition to all of that, they're simply cultural relations that are highly significant. One is Christian Zionism. That goes back way before Jewish Zionism, and it's been very significant as an elite phenomenon. And by now it's a mass phenomenon. The mass evangelical movement in the United States, which is enormous, happens to be extremely supportive of Israel and also very anti-Semitic. They go together. It's a huge popular base of support. In the elite level, it's always been true. Another factor which doesn't get talked about much, and I don't exactly know how to measure it, but I think it's significant, is that take a look at the countries in the world that are most supportive of Israel. Which are they? They're the countries that are called the Anglosphere, England and its offshoots, the United States, Canada, Australia. They're the ones who tend to vote with Israel in the Security Council or most supportive of it and so on. What are these countries? These are countries which were created by immigrants who eliminated and exterminated the indigenous population. That's our history. United States, Canada didn't kill all of them, killed most of them. Australia killed almost all of them. The United States exterminated most of them. These are settler colonial societies. Well, when they look at Israel, they say, yeah, must be the right thing to do. We did it. Got to be the right thing to do. And that's all now tied up with all kind of biblical legends and so on and so forth. So that's a heavy, that's a pretty complicated a collection of factors that all go the same way. Any particular one of them may not matter that much, but they're all pretty much going the same way, and there's no opposition. Very little organized opposition. And that's our fault. There should be. And that has to be done by popular organizing, which is by no means impossible. It's been done in harder cases.
Thank you very much.
Very helpful.
Hi, my name is Will Naus. I just wanted to ask you about your views on the BDS movement. I've noticed that it's gotten a lot of traction throughout the world, but especially college SJPs recently. What's your opinion? Because I've noticed a lot of people on the left are behind it, but a lot, specifically Norman Finkelstein, have also talked out against some of its underlying ideals. So how do you feel about it?
You have to distinguish, first of all, between BDS tactics and the BDS movement. That's not the same thing. So BDS tactics have been very successful. The most significant by far so far is the European Union, which has issued strong directives. They don't have the force of law, but they're directives to ban any connections between European businesses and governmental institutions with any entity in Israel that's involved in the occupation. That's pretty serious. Most European countries by now have at least gotten to the point of demanding that products from the West Bank be marked so consumers will know if something says imported from Israel, they'll know whether it means imported from the occupied territories. Those are quite a significant moves. The American, just recently, the Presbyterian Church decided on divestment from several multinational corporations that are operating in the West Bank. That's really significant. And there's no, these tactics can be very effective. I mean, they, you know, they're not going to end Israeli actions, but they're more than just a minor irritant. They tend to isolate Israel more and more in the international arena, and that arouses opposition. Some, at the moment, inside Israel, it's just the reaction is kind of circling the wagons. You know, let's be more militant. But over time, it can erode support for the policies, and that's BDS tactics. The BDS movement itself has not been involved in most of this. It has initiated important actions, and it's mobilized plenty of people. You're right about this traction it's gotten, which is very significant. But if you take a look at the actions that have been successful, virtually all of them have to do with the occupied territories. There's a really strong case to be made. In fact, participation in any way in the occupation is literally criminal. So it's saying, let's obey the law. Okay, that's a strong way to organize people. Let's obey the law. And it's been successful, and it's successful in getting people to pay attention to the questions, to the significant questions. There are other planks in the platform of the BDS movement which you can give a justification for, but they're tactically are very unlikely to be effective and haven't been effective unless a lot of organizing and educational work will be done. Now, the other two planks have to do with rights of Palestinians within Israel, and that's a legitimate cause, but it's very hard to get people to boycott a country because people within it are not getting equal rights. Do you boycott the United States, France? You just can't really mobilize people that way. The third issue is the right of return of refugees. Again, that's a serious issue, but you have to treat it seriously. There's almost no support in the world for allowing the refugees to return. It could develop. I think there are ways to develop it, but you have to do the preliminary work. You try to propose that to people, they get virtually no support. Tactics have to be designed so they're going to be effective. There's no use designing tactics that make you feel you're doing the right thing. You know, that's useless, even harmful. Every activist, this ought to be second nature to activists. You shape your tactics so they're going to work. And they're going to work, first of all, to change policy, but most significantly to organize popular support, to expand popular support so that people understand more, are willing to do more. And the plank of the platform that has had that effect is occupation-oriented. Maybe it can change, but you have to first do a lot of educational and organizational work. And if that hasn't been done, the efforts are likely to have a backlash, which will even be worse than before. That's true of tactics generally. Activists just have to understand that.
Thank you very much.
This will be our last question, so sorry for everyone else.
Hi, Professor Chomsky. Thank you for being here tonight with us. My question is about what were your thoughts on the recent reports by the Shin Bet that revealed the Hamas coup plot, and how does this shape our understanding of the unity government that the Palestinians have been trying to form? Thank you.
So the question of why Hamas accepted those, from their point of view, pretty onerous terms? Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. My understanding, to get a good answer to that, you'd have to know a lot more about internal Gazan politics and interaction than I know how to find out from the outside. But I have talked about it years ago to people like Raji Sarani, who really know it well. And years ago, he said, and I think this has been shown, that over the years, Hamas has been pretty forthcoming in accepting terms for unity government that would not reflect their own positions, but would advance the Palestinian cause. As far as I know, that's accurate. I mean, if you want better information, you might ask people like, say, Sarah Roy, who's studied Hamas closely, but it looks like that. And that's plainly what happened this time. And it does infuriate Israel, because it brings Gaza and the West Bank together. And as I mentioned, there's a strong geostrategic interest for Israel to keep them apart. But it is pretty striking that Hamas accepted those terms. Just to think what they were. There's a unity government with no Hamas representatives, none. After having defeated the coup in the West Bank, they are now permitting Fatah security people to come back to guard the borders, to guard the crossings, and to operate internally, and maybe even take part in the governance. And they accepted those three conditions, including recognition of Israel. That's a pretty strong stand. And I think it supports the view that I've heard from Sarani and others who know it, that they really have been interested in achieving some kind of unity government that will advance the Palestinian cause. Their view, I've heard this from their leadership too, but I don't know how seriously to take it when you hear it from the leadership. When I hear it from someone like Sarani, it's more convincing. Mm-hmm. But their view has been that the Palestinian Authority has refused all along under U.S. and Israeli pressure, mm-hmm. which is not implausible. Israel has a lot of weapons, remember. The Palestinian Authority is even financially is dependent on Israel for its survival. Israel controls its finances. Of course, it controls everything militarily. That's one of the problems about... there's a lot of pressure among the Palestinians. It's an interesting development to try to join the International Criminal Court and bring charges against Israel. Israel and the U.S. are frantically opposed to this. But it's worth remembering that there's a real cost. Israel is in a position to completely strangle the Palestinian Authority, and they say they're going to do it if charges are ever brought. You shouldn't be too surprised at that. The United States, for example, has an even stronger position. I mean, it isn't too well known, but there's actually the U.S., of course, refused to join the International Criminal Court. But there is legislation signed by the president, which in Europe is called the Netherlands Invasion Act. It's legislation that authorizes the president to invade the Netherlands if any American is brought to The Hague for trial. We're a pretty violent country, and people are afraid of us for good reasons.
Thank you.
MIT Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky speaking at Indelis Cafe in Cambridge, Massachusetts on September 4th, 2014. Special thanks to Sammy and Rihanna of Indelis Cafe for sponsoring this event. Recorded and edited for radio and the web by Chuck Rosina. Thanks for listening.